This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on assignment. Politicians of all stripes have argued over the role of government for decades. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan declared government is not the solution. During his 1996 State of the Union address, Bill Clinton announced that the era of big government is over. This presidential campaign is turning out no different. Both candidates have talked about the need to change the way the federal government works. But what does less government mean for you? We'll talk with two people who study public attitudes towards government, and as always, we want to hear from you. Later on the opinion page, can you compare the financial crisis with the attacks of 9/11? But first, what do you want the government to do for you? And if you want less government in your life, what are you willing to sacrifice to make the government smaller? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We start with Andrew Kohut, director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Always good to have you with us, Andy.
Happy to be with you, Lynn.
So you've polled people to find out what their attitudes are towards government, and big surprise, they're inconsistent.
They are inconsistent. You know, there are ebbs and flows of criticisms of government and support for an activist government. But one thing that we've seen for at least the last 20 years, and probably longer than that, is this two-minded feelings about government. On the one hand, people are critical of the way government does its thing. They're suspicious of it. They usually think it doesn't do the job very well. But on the other hand, the public almost consistently says, well, you know, the government should really deal with this pressing problem that we're facing. I'll read you just a few statistics.
Okay.
62% believe that things run by the government are usually inefficient and wasteful. That's 62% from a 2007 survey, but go back any time over the past 20 years and you get a statistic like that. The percentage of people who think the government controls too much of their lives is 64%. Again, very little variation over the past 20 years. And only about 31% say they trust that they think that the government gets it right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of criticism of government.
But in the poll, I think that you took between on attitudes from 1997 up to 2007, I believe, you did see some changes in attitudes, didn't you?
Oh, we saw much more criticisms of government in the mid-90s, and to some extent that subsided. But where the real action is on the other side of the equation, and that is the extent to which people want government to do things. And there we've got a fair amount of consistency despite this change. 69% of the people that we questioned in 2007 say it's a responsibility of government to take care of people who can't take care of themselves. Very little variation on that over time. 83% say there need to be strict laws and regulations that the government sets to protect the environment. We have, however, seen some decline and now rise again in support for an activist government. For example, in 1987, 71% believed the government should help people who can't help themselves. In the mid-90s, in the Republican Revolution era, that 71 fell to 57%. It's now back up to 69%. So we are in a period where there is actually more support for a strong safety net, yet pretty high criticisms of the very government that people are calling.
Right. And more support for a strong safety net, but not more support for more taxes or to pay for it.
Sorry. Wait, got to make a correction there.
Really?
63% of a poll we did 2 months ago, U.S. government should guarantee health care for all, even if it means more taxes.
Wow, okay.
People should be willing to pay higher taxes to protect the environment.
That's new,
67%.
Isn't it?
No? If you ask people about paying taxes for specific things that they think are problems,
okay,
they give you a different reaction than to the idea of paying taxes generally, because people will look at that and say, that's going to go off into some boondoggle or be wasted by this inefficient government.
All right. Well, then let me ask you a couple of specifics. I mean, what are some of the specific programs that people say they want from the government? I mean, what do you hear are maybe the most popular programs?
Well, some of the most popular are the government should be taking actions to protect the environment. The government should be helping people who can't help themselves, particularly in times that are not very good. And again, that is a bit of a reversal from where we were in the mid-90s, but pretty much where we were in the late 1980s.
Do you see any difference?
Let me just add another thing. Okay. There's a great desire also for the government to spend money on health care and education.
Right.
More generally.
All right, then just one more question before we go to our next guest, and that is, then what do people mean when they say that the government controls too much of their lives?
Well, they're afraid of government. They're afraid of Big Brother. For example, when we polled people about indecency and objectionable material on television, we said, what's the greater risk, harmful content on television or undue government restrictions? 48% undue government restrictions, 41% that content that they so worry about.
All right. Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Larry, and he's calling from Frankfort, Kentucky. And hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Yes, I think the idea of so many people that I hear talk about big government or too much government, it seems like they need to start thinking about the idea of balanced government, which your first speaker is kind of addressing, and that is that, yes, we do need governmental help when it comes to the environment. For one thing, you've got things crossing borders. You've got things that no one state can control or no one entity control, and sadly, too many companies and things that are causing a lot of the point source pollution seem to be interested mainly in the bottom line. And so you need somebody there to kind of make sure that the environment is being taken care of. And I think the same thing is true with finance. Too often with finance, the ones that want the deregulation are the ones who want to be able to make more money, the big corporations and things, but the little people kind of get ground up in this machinery because there aren't enough measures to protect them when you have things like the mortgage crisis or the health crisis or those kinds of things. So we need to stop thinking about too much or big government, and we need to start thinking about balanced government.
All right, I like that idea of balanced government versus big government. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that.
And thanks for your call, Larry.
I think that reflects public opinion. The American public sees, in some respects, the government as the court of last resort, but they want that court of last resort to come in and do what it has to do to right the problems and do it in the most modest and least intrusive way.
All right. I want to bring Paul Light into this discussion now. He's also here with us in Studio 3A in Washington, and he's a professor of public policy at New York University. His most recent book is A Government Ill Executed, The Decline of the Federal Service and How to Reverse It. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Nice to be here.
So let me just ask you first, have Americans always had this sort of ambivalent attitude towards government, or is this a new phenomenon?
Well, I think our founders actually had an ambivalent attitude. They wanted this balance, actually, that your caller just talked about. They wanted a government that was strong enough to protect us from foreign and domestic threats, but they wanted the government not so strong that it could become a weapon for the oppression of strong minorities. In that regard, we want this balance, and we see that today. Most Americans want the federal government to be out of their bedroom. There's no doubt about that. But they want the government to be in their kitchen on safe food and safe drinking water. They want it to be in their living room. They want it to be on the roads. They want government to be there in much of their life to help them and to guarantee their safety.
Can you have it both ways? I mean, can you have it and do all Americans want the government have the same attitudes towards when the government should be in control of social issues or when they should be just taking care of the roads, or is there even there's a divide within Americans about that?
You know, I'm going to throw every tough public opinion question to Andy Cohut because I just think he's terrific, and he'll have the answer. I mean, sure, there are divisions. I think one of the things that we see in the data I look at, much of it Andy's, is that we have had some pretty significant breakdowns in government over the last 20 years, and those tend to have a undercurrent of impact on the public. So when you look at the number of Americans who've paid attention to accidents like meat inspections and so forth, you end up discovering that there's kind of this corrosive effect over time in terms of government's ability to do its job, and real concern about inefficiency. Yes, I want benefits for myself. I want government to do these things, but I think it's very inefficient. And those attitudes have been pretty consistent over time in a kind of a grand sense that government just really can't do very well as it's trying to do well.
Yeah. What would you say right now is sort of the source of people's dissatisfaction with government? I mean, why does it work when politicians stand up there and say, you know, we're going to make government better? I mean, that's, you know, and sometimes in very broad terms they'll say that. Why does that work so well with people?
Well, I think it goes to that broad disquiet with bigness in general, big government, big labor, big business, and so forth. But it also touches kind of the American sort of character, the desire for the freedom from interference. I think that it always resonates because government's pretty good at taking those kinds of punches, and there are lots of examples where government doesn't do very well. One can argue that both Obama and McCain, the two presidential candidates, can mount an effective run against government today because government was somehow connected to the bailout crisis and didn't do its job in some way. And I'm sure that's appearing in some of Andy's data, or at least I hope so, having said that.
Well, I'm going to remind Paul of a study that he and I did in 1997. It was the most comprehensive survey about why people distrust government. And one of the things that it found was a lot of this distrust of government is linked to the public's general satisfaction, or mostly dissatisfaction, with the way things are going in the country. So we are at a time when the satisfaction with the state of the nation is not at an all-time low, but it's pretty close.
Right.
And when you ask people about government, they think, my gosh, those folks in Washington, they play a big part of this, and the government is at least in part responsible. On the other hand, they're divided about it. In fact, our latest opinion survey show, taken this weekend, the public is divided still about this bailout that just passed on Friday.
And how much the government should have intervened.
And how much the government should have intervened, and whether they're letting the big guys off the hook and all of that.
We are talking about the role of government in your life. We want to hear from you. The number is 800-989-8255. How much do you want the government in your life? And if you want the government out of your life, what are you willing to sacrifice in terms of programs and services? Give us a call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Poll after poll shows that Americans say that they do not want big government in their lives. The numbers show a contradiction in that many Americans also say they want the government to provide protection and basic services. So what do you want government to do for you? And if you want less government in your life, what are you willing to sacrifice to make it smaller? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Andy Kohut is still with us. He's the director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. And we're also joined by Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University. His most recent book is called A Government Ill Executed, The Decline of the Federal Service and How to Reverse It. If you'd like to give us a call, the number again is 800-989-8255. And we are going to take a call now from Chris, who is calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd like to say that I do want government in my life in ways that I feel are positive, such as health care and, you know, repairing the roads, basic things like that. But I think there's a very large amount of government that has expanded recently, the past 50 years or so, that can definitely be cut away. And the main branch that I'm talking about, well, for instance, is Homeland Security, which was created under the Bush administration. And then we also have the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA, which to me appears to be four branches of secret police in a way, and I don't really think that's necessary for our country to have that many branches.
Andy, have you polled on this, on the sense of privacy and whether the government has the right to you know, be listening to people's phone conversations, you know, things like that.
There is, despite all of the criticisms of the Bush administration's war in Iraq, there is a fair amount of support for the tenets of its terrorism policies. For example, there's been consistent support for warrantless wiretaps. There's been support for monitoring the finances without court orders of groups that are suspected of terrorism. And so I think that there's a lot less support, and I know there's a lot less support for military spending these days than there was 5 years ago, 3 years ago even. I don't think that there is that kind of discontent with the CIA, the FBI, and Homeland Security.
People
feel protected by them.
Do you know, in terms of how people react to questions on these kinds of issues, how it falls politically in terms of their party affiliation?
Huge divide, with Republicans and Democrats on the, you know, the Democrats concerned, Republicans less concerned, and independents falling somewhere in the middle.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for your call, Chris.
Thank you.
And Paulette, is this divide that we were just talking about in terms of attitude towards government, is that really at the base of this problem of divisive partisanship that we see becoming so much of a problem, just in terms of governance, really, at times?
Well, I think there's a great deal of consensus, as Andy is saying. I think that part of the issue when we take a look at attitudes towards agencies like Homeland Security is a very real public perception that they're not doing their jobs well. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you talk to people inside Homeland Security, Homeland Security employees think it's the worst place to work in government. And actually, it shows that way. Kind of a general sense that why are we spending all this money and getting so little in terms of results? We have a Food and Inspection Service. We have a Food and Drug Administration. How come we've got counterfeit heparin? How come we've got problems ensuring safe meat? And I think some of that gets tangled up in as people kind of go through the latest meltdown. And one of the things that, you know, I've been arguing of late is that, well, if you want a government that works better and costs less, you better be willing to pay more for that government.
Why?
Because we've been disinvesting in government. Mm-hmm. We've been cutting positions. We've been reducing access to resources. There aren't enough food inspectors, for example. We've got those airplane groundings last spring. Not enough airline inspectors.
On the other hand, haven't you said that, you know, that when all of the baby boomers who are in government right now, I forget what the number is, maybe 600,000 when they start retiring, that they shouldn't just automatically be replaced? I mean, I take it from that you're saying it should be a leaner government.
We can have a leaner government. What you know is happening as the baby boomers are leaving is that they're vacating positions at the middle and higher levels of government. At the bottom of government, we've got these huge shortages. You see them at the Veterans Administration. You see them at Social Security, all over the place. And what we need to do as the baby boomers leave is redistribute their jobs down to the bottom where the work gets done. That's where we've had the big snafus over the last year or two, this kind of cascade.
Yeah.
That's where we've had, you know, the problems with Hurricane Katrina. And I think those do have an effect on this kind of notion that, yeah, I want government involved in my life, but I'd like it to perform well. Andy and I did some work together on a project once looking at customer satisfaction towards government. And the public believes, you know, has divisions about what it wants in terms of bigger, smaller, and so forth. But they want government to work.
Yeah.
They want professionalism. They want responsiveness. And one of the things that we're seeing is a fairly significant drip, drip, drip effect of breakdowns in the way government actually performs. And we got to do something about it.
All right. Let's take another call. We're going to go to, I believe it's Camille, and she is calling from Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, go ahead. Thanks.
Yes. Okay, we are homeschoolers here in Birmingham, Alabama, and something that's kind of bothered me is that neither of the political candidates have really talked about homeschooling and what their take is on government intervention in homeschooling. Now, and it's actually a hotly contested issue within the homeschool community. But there are a number of us who we would actually rather forego a tax credit or anything like that if it means that we can remain independent.
What, you don't want any government intervention or regulation at all of homeschooling?
Right. Exactly. We feel that, you know, if we've made the conscious decision to educate our children at home, that, you know, we would rather not have the government interfere with, for example, well, I suppose it's a thin edge of the wedge kind of thing, that, you know, if they can dictate this, then perhaps they can, that clears the way to dictate more and perhaps even more than that. And the next thing you know, what you end up is having perhaps a public school at home, and that's clearly not, you know, why we're choosing, why we've made this choice for our families.
Paul Light?
Well, I think here we have a conflict between the public good, which is to make sure that children are educated well and become productive citizens, and the private good. The assumption with the homeschooling movement has always been, perhaps rightly so, that children who are homeschooled do very well. Government gets involved in this by saying, well, what exactly are you teaching? Are they being given the basic skills to succeed in our changing economy? And there's this very difficult and obvious tension when government starts to say, look, you've got to do X, Y, and Z in the classroom, even if that classroom happens to be your kitchen and you're the teacher.
All right. Thanks for your call. Interesting perspective, Camille.
Okay.
And I'd like to also read an email now from Alan in St. Louis, Missouri. The U.S. Constitution clearly tells us what the government should do. It should form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. And it should regulate, regulate, regulate. Which I'm not sure everyone would agree with. What is, well, let me ask you first, Andy Cohut. I mean, have you polled on regulation, which of course now we're hearing a lot about regulation with what's been going on with Wall Street. Was it a lack of regulation that allowed that to happen? Do we want more regulation now? And I think there's lots of opinions about that.
We have been tracking a question about regulation of business now for close to 20 years. And the last time we asked it, we found 57% saying government regulation of business usually does more harm than good. I would guess, Lynn, that when we go into the field in another month, the numbers will be quite different. You know, a lot of what we hear in this from the public in with respect to government views about it and the desire for it, on the other hand, reflects the temper of the times. And, the Reagan Revolution did one thing, and there's a counter response. And I think we're going to have a counter response on regulation of business.
All right, let's take a call now from Andrew. Andrew is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Lynn. I'm really split on this issue. I want government out of the picture in certain things, like, oh, here's an old one we haven't heard from in a while, electoral college reform. I'd love to see that happen. I think we're a much more informed culture than we were when that process was put in place, and I think some definite definite changes should be made there. However, I'd like to see the government more involved in, say, common sense issues. For those people who need to have their consumerism gene re-educated, let's make the back of the credit card application as easy to understand as the front of it. Let's see, you know, government get involved in re-educating the American consumer and teaching them that not everybody needs a wall-sized flat panel TV, not everybody needs an animatronic display in their
yard.
I'm
going to back up on that one. You want the government teaching people that they don't need a flat-screen TV?
Well, just I think government needs to take a more active role in kind of educating the American consumer as to, you know, to what it means to live within your means. But you don't see a lot of that sponsored, a lot of that sponsored by the government. And I would like to see some government programs that could do that, to reach out to people that kind of say, you know, let's take a look at what it means to live within your means and what are needs and what are wants.
It's interesting because I'm just thinking to myself that there are any number of people I would think who would really just chafe under that idea incredibly, that the government should in any way tell them.
I don't mean mandated education. I don't want to see them standing over us, you know, with a yardstick. But I think at the same time, I'm thinking of something, you know, something more like, you know, feedthepig.org. We see commercials for that on TV. But, you know, why can't the government step in and say, you know, we're in this, we're in a financial mess, and yes, this happened because of a lot of people on Wall Street, but also we can't ignore the fact that it also happened because people were living way outside their means.
All right. Paul Light, let's respond. Thanks so much for your call, Andrew.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Well, again, you get into the issue of just how much of that Americans will tolerate. I think the founders understood there would be regulation. Once you get past the preamble, you get into all sorts of components of the Constitution that envision regulatory activity, and we certainly had it from the very beginning. At the Department of Treasury, some regulations that still exist to this day on tax collection. But, you know, I mean, the question is where government deploys these power. If it goes too far, then it creates kind of a weakening of public support for all regulations, some that they do desperately need. So you have to be careful about extending its reach. We are in a period where there is a lot of interest in financial regulation, and much of it may be quite warranted. But again, you got this pendulum going back and forth, and as sure as you can see, we'll have a re-regulatory period, and then 10 years from now, we'll be deregulating again, going back and forth as government tries to adjust.
We are talking about the role of government in your life. The number is 800-989-8255 if you would like to join the discussion, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call now from Amy, and Amy is calling from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Amy. Amy, are you there? I think Amy has... Amy? Amy is not there anymore. I wanted to ask, Paul, and I wanted to turn to you on this. I mean, how much of a role now should the government... And do you think that people are really divided about this, about how much the government should be playing in fixing the economy and making things right now?
I don't know. I was listening to the radio coming on over, and I was certainly hoping for a divine hand somewhere. You know, please do something before 4 o'clock. The public is really looking for some sort of answer here, I'm sure. And they're, I think, a bit confused about, you know, who should be providing the guidance. Government really did fail in many aspects on this particular crisis. Congress has blame to take, so does this administration and previous administrations. So there'll be a lot of pressure on the next president and Congress to fix what's wrong here. And I think most Americans will accept it as long as it's not seen as a bailout of Wall Street again.
All right, let's see if we can get one more call in here. We're going to go to Keith in Arlington, Massachusetts. Keith, you on the air?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I just comment that I would like to see a smaller government, and there's probably nothing in the federal budget that I wouldn't want to see cut. And I mean absolutely nothing. And even though I'm a strong supporter of defense, I think there's lots of room to cut in the defense budget. And I can provide many examples. I live in the Boston area, and the Big Dig was a $15, $16 billion project. It just seems to me we could have built the road for a lot less. And my father's a farmer in Alabama, and I know he gets – there are a lot of farm programs that pull money into farmers that is really a boondoggle that – took a peanut field out and put it into hay, and now he gets paid for the peanuts he's not growing.
Yeah. I think what you're saying, Keith, reflects a lot of what we've been saying here on the show, which is, and thanks so much for your call, which is that it's maybe not so much government, but government that's not run well or not done well. And just to close out on one last email here, I personally don't, this is from Connie. In Idaho, she said, I don't mind the idea of bigger government, but it must not be wasteful. My biggest fear when government starts to slash is that the people who have the absolute least are the ones to suffer terribly. I'm squarely in the middle class, and I don't mind paying more taxes if I know the government is going to be conscientious about easing And in this case, her main priority is the suffering of the poor. But again, it's that the government has to be run well and efficiently.
Very consistent responses, criticisms of government performance, the way it does. Business is seen as doing, the private sector is generally seen, maybe not right now, as being more efficient and more effective. And again, there's a lot of consistency in this attitude.
And that's, Paul, what you've been saying.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, it's useful to remember that the founders designed this engine here to pursue arduous and extensive enterprise for the public benefit. We do a lot of not very arduous, not very important enterprise that are for private benefit, and that's where public opinion often slides against government.
Paul Light is a professor of public service at New York University. We were also joined by Andrew Kohut, director of Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Thanks to both of you for being with us. And coming up, is the fallout from the current financial crisis even bigger than 9/11? The opinion page is next. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Now, the opinion page. The Dow dropped below 10,000 for the first time in 4 years today. We've seen Congress pass the giant bailout plan. Last month, employers cut more than 150,000 jobs. Obviously, this economic crisis is big, but how big? In an op-ed in Sunday's Washington Post, David Rothkopf argues that the current financial crisis may well have far greater and more lasting ramifications than the terrorist attacks on 9/11. We have a link to that piece on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. David Rothkopf is currently a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start out with that comparison, because people may find that a surprising comparison to look at this economic downturn and think, well, how do you even begin to compare it to this terrible tragedy that occurred on 9/11 with the thousands of people who were killed?
Well, of course, you know, the human toll of 9/11 was grievous, and in no way by making the comparison does one want to minimize it. The reason to make the comparison is to show how big and significant the events that are happening now really are. 9/11 was what many of us thought would be the sort of signal historical event of this presidency and perhaps of this decade. But here we are 7 years later, and it's clear that something is happening in the global economy that is not only going to touch the lives of billions of people, have human toll itself as the economy goes into recession and particularly the poorest are hurt, but may actually change politics in America, the way the system works in America, and the way the system works in a world in ways that far outstrip that associated with 9/11. I mean, after all, we were in a war on terror for decades before that. In fact, George W. Bush was not the first Bush put in charge of the war on terror. George H.W. Bush, when he was vice president under Reagan, was put in charge of a war on terror. That was not even the first attack on the World Trade Center. That had occurred 8 years earlier. So that's been an ongoing thing. I think what we're at here is the end of an era. In the United States and in the West, you might call it the end of Reagan-Thatcherism, the end of leave it to the markets, the end of, you know, it's always better if government does less. And it's akin to, you know, when Reagan started, we were at the end of the run of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like...
You really see it as that much of a era-changing moment.
I absolutely do. I think, you know, the New Deal ran 35 or 40 years. The Reagan era ran 30-plus years. And I think we're on to something... or we will be onto something new here.
Now, you write that this is the end of American-style capitalism and American supremacy. Let me ask you first about that American...
Well, I didn't write that.
Something
I said
to that effect.
Some people are asserting it's the end of American-style capitalism and American supremacy. And they're not just our enemies. They're, you know, allies in Europe, people who are within the financial system. So we need to take these warnings very seriously.
If it is the end of American-style capitalism, are we? What will replace it? Where are we going from here?
Well, I think American-style capitalism has come to be viewed as this kind of ideal where We adopt neoliberal policies in which the government plays as little a role as possible, in which the kind of the Darwinist aspect of the market works, and you know, the strong survive, and we go through, you know, creative destruction, and we let all of that happen, and we rely on the market to sort of determine what kind of a society we'll have and who will benefit, and we say, look, we provide you with opportunity. If you seize that opportunity, that's enough. And what we've seen is, particularly in this era in which financial leaders have said, we want to be self-regulating, which sort of took this to the ultimate extreme, is that when you rely on the market overshoots, greed takes a toll, and the meltdowns can have dire consequences for millions and billions of people who are innocent bystanders. And so government has a role to play. Government must step in. Government must balance it out. It must not only enforce laws that are on the books, but we need to tackle the real problems of how do you regulate global markets that are beyond the reach of national governments, that are full of financial instruments that no one understands. I mean, you know, look, I mean, it's hard to laugh, but look what's happening today in the markets following this bailout. Mm-hmm. What is absolutely clear is no one in Washington and very few people on Wall Street actually understand what's happening right now.
Yeah. I'd like to invite our listeners to join us. We want to know, do you agree that the long-term effects of the economic crisis will be greater than the aftermath of 9/11? So give us a call at 800-989-8255. And you can also send us an email, and that address is talk@npr.org. And again, my guest is David Rothkopf. He is a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And we are discussing his op-ed piece, which appeared in the Washington Post on Sunday. Is there any way to go back to what you were saying earlier, which is that, and I said you wrote it, but you were quoting people saying that American-style capitalism, American supremacy may be at the end. One person I think who you mentioned was the president of France, Sarkozy. I mean, is there any way to interpret those kinds of comments, not that that's a direct quote, but those kinds of inferences as being just anti-Americanism, a sort of moment of Europeans relishing a moment of America being in decline?
You certainly can. And I think I've seen more headlines using the word Schadenfreude in the past, you know, week, which speaks to their relishing the decline than I have in a long, long time. You know, having said that, you've got the president of France, you've got the German finance minister, you've got political leaders in the United Kingdom, you've got leaders on Wall Street, George Soros talking about market fundamentalism having gone too far, you've got the Chinese, you've got the Japanese. You know, every place you look in the world, people are seeing cracks in the armor. Here was the system that was going to deliver wealth to everyone in the world. All you had to do was sit back. And in fact, if you were in government, the less you did, the better the system was going to work. And what's happened? Inequality has grown. The top 1,000 people in the world today have assets that are greater than that of the bottom 2.5 billion people in the world today. The markets themselves have turned into a casino. The meltdown is something that is now beyond the capability of government to control. And it looks like we are going to have to prepare ourselves for a downturn that will certainly be a recession, could be worse than that, could extend beyond the United States, and where the government's going to have to play a big role in helping people back to their feet.
All right, let's take a call from Sean, who's calling from Corvallis, Oregon. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I'm glad to join you guys here. So I completely agree with your speaker there, and that the effects of the financial crisis today will be much greater than the effects of the world trade bombing. And the basis of my reasoning on that is that, the world trade bombing crisis or whatever, we had a clear and definite enemy. You know, it was the terror-loving terrorists, and we, could go after them. And the response for economic was everyone should consume, which I think probably had a little to do with where we're at now, because we have such a huge savings versus spending discrepancy in the whole nation, just as everyone, not just the government or anything, but people in general. Whereas today we have an economic crisis that no one knows a clear way to get out of.
Yeah.
you know, we have these solutions being proposed, but they're not concise, and they're not, I mean, they are concise maybe, but they don't have any guarantee of working.
Let me ask you something, Sean. I'm curious about something. After 9/11, I remember very clearly that there was a lot of talk about when are things ever going to be normal again. Do you have that sense right now that your sense of normalcy is being shaken up considerably?
I think that the media has been a horrible driving factor in this. That they've been, it's such a media-rich environment we live in. It's driving down consumer confidence the economy is driven by consumer confidence, and without consumer confidence being, there, and with, everything for the last year has been about recession or economic downturn, whatever you want to call it, driving down, consumer confidence. I'm not sure if I.
It is a period of, well, as we've been saying, it's a period of great uncertainty, and mm-hmm. And one where many people are feeling like perhaps it's going to take a long time before we all feel like we've reached a sense of normalcy again, like at the time after 9/11. Thanks so much for your call, Sean.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, David. What are? It sounds like you're saying we are at a point where we have to create a whole. We can't create a whole new economic system, but what kind of global economy are we going to see, and who is going to be in the forefront of creating it?
Well, it remains to be seen who's going to be at the forefront of creating it. I was listening to you read the news, and we have both candidates talking about absurd trivia in terms of, each other's pass. While the stock market is down 700 points and last week's big story of the bailout doesn't seem to be working. So, we do need to find leadership, and that's going to be a big issue. But I think we need to recognize, first of all, that markets have a lot of value. They are vital to our success, but markets have always needed to be regulated, and we need to find a proper balance between markets and government. Recognizing that we're in a global economy, that means we need global governance mechanisms. We may well need a global monetary authority that brings together all the leading governments of the world. I think we're going to really need to revamp, in fact, the entire system of global governance we've got. We're going to need new regulations in the United States. We're going to need to use technology to make the financial system, which is impossibly complex right now, much more transparent, not only to investors, but also to regulators. We really need to rethink government from the bottom up. Mm. To find a better balance and to ensure that government can play its traditional role of regulator and also of promoting growth in the right places in an economy and supporting those that markets leave behind. Because as we've seen, markets don't have consciences. And if it were up to markets, the weak, the elderly, the sick, the people left bankrupt by events like this, they would be left behind. Because that's the way of the market. And we need to say, well, markets can do good, but governments also have a role to play. And it's a cop-out to say, just let's leave them at the side of the road. We need to do government as efficiently and as effectively as we would expect businesses to operate. And that requires creative leadership. And right now, Congress has the lowest approval rating in its history. And I'm not 100% sure where that's going to come from.
All right, let's take another call now from Larry. He's calling from Chico, California. Hi, Larry.
Yes, thank you. Your question is on, I guess our opinion is the 9/11 thing worse or better than what happened with, the World Trade Center and this this debacle that's going on right now in Wall Street. And my feelings and my own thinking and my opinion is that, hell yes, this here dwarfs the 9/11 thing because, yes, as awful as it was, they lost about 3,000 people. This here is going to kill a hell of a lot of people.
Well, it's going to be tough on a lot of people, I think, yes. I think that's the point.
It depends on what your opinion or what your interpretation of kill is, as opposed to going totally bankrupt and being in a gutter or living out of a cardboard house.
All right, Larry, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to ask our guest to respond to your comment. And I just want to remind our audience that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I think that I don't think you can talk really in terms of fatalities with regard to the current crisis. That's not exactly the point I think you were trying to make.
Well, I'm certainly not, although I do think that if we go from a U.S. recession to a global recession, inevitably those kind of downturns actually impact those who live in absolute poverty the most. And, you know, we already have 35 or 40,000 children who die every day from lack of access to food, medicine, or clean water. And those numbers will go up in a global economic downturn. Countries will be able to give less to help them. There will be less to go around. So there certainly will be fatalities out of this. But it's not just that. It's not just saying the economic cost of this or the human cost is X or Y. It's whether we're really at a historical turning point, whether in 50 years people will look at this and say this was much as the Depression was, and that it changed our attitudes towards capitalism and towards democracy and towards the various countries in the world and what their leadership role is. And I think that it's quite clear that yes, it is. This is on the same scale.
You know, there's an email here from Derek from Wisconsin, and he says, based on the continuing work of Brad Setzer, Nouriel Roubini, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, and others, we are at the same stage as England was after World War I, when confidence was lost in the pound sterling. We cannot imagine that we will not be in the center of the financial world, but we very much will be pushed to the periphery over the coming decades as other countries establish trading relationships and other mechanisms to handle their transactions.
Well, look, this is a legitimate issue. Guys like Nouriel Roubini have been, you know, predicting this was going to happen for some time. And it's a real concern. You know, when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were on the ropes, the Treasury Department got a call from the Chinese, our creditors, and they said, look, if you don't solve this problem, we're not going to continue to buy your debt. Well, if they don't buy our debt, if they don't buy Treasury bonds, we don't get to do the things that we take for granted in the United States anymore. We've just upped our debt ceiling to $11 trillion. Mm. And yet we've got two candidates running for president who say, well, I wouldn't cut back. I wouldn't cut back on my programs. Well, that's ludicrous. It's ludicrous. Not only will those programs not be things that we can afford, but we're going to start having to have conversations that you can't even talk about in polite society in Washington anymore.
Much less if you're campaigning for president.
Well, right. But the defense budget of right. the United States will be cut substantially in the next 8 years because we can't afford it. And if we don't start to get our house in order, people are going to stop buying our debt. They're going to stop using the dollar as the reserve currency, and we will find ourselves like Britain on the sidelines. The point is we have a choice now, and the question is whether we'll seize the opportunity to make the right choices.
David Rothkopf is the author of Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.